From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with music critic and author Joseph Horowitz. In his new book, Understanding Toscanini, Horowitz says Toscanini's performances led to wider interest in classical music and to the phenomenon of conductor as superstar. Also, novelist Julian Barnes says it's possible to love both the best and the worst writing. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc reissue of pianist Arthur Schnabel. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg looks at accents in the movies, everything from ancient Rome to outer space. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is Joseph Horowitz, who's written a new book titled Understanding Toscanini, How He Became an American Culture God and Helped Create a New Audience for Old Music. It's an examination of the role of classical music in popular culture.
Mr. Toscanini, we breathlessly await your masterful baton, go on and sling it. And if you can, you've simply got to swing it. I said swing it.
You might have expected some Toscanini there, but Horowitz's book isn't a conventional biography. It's about the phenomena of the conductor as celebrity. After all, even pop stars like Sophie Tucker sang about Toscanini. Horowitz sees Toscanini as the first in a line of superstar conductors. He wonders if their personal hype isn't overshadowing the music itself. It was a 1951 recording of Arturo Toscanini leading the NBC Symphony Orchestra in Beethoven's Symphony No. 7. Toscanini's work with the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic introduced him to American audiences. He made his New York debut in 1908, but it was his work with the NBC Symphony, an orchestra that RCA assembled for his exclusive use, that propelled Toscanini into the reigning icon of our musical high culture. My guest, Joseph Horowitz, was a music critic for the New York Times from 1976 to 1980. Since 81, he has been program editor for New York's 92nd Street Y. His earlier work, Conversations with Arau, won the 1983 ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for Excellence in Music Writing. Joseph Horowitz's new book, Understanding Toscanini, is published by Knopf. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I think the main question in your book is, are superstars democratizing or commercializing high culture? Why did you choose Toscanini as the focus for that question?
Well, Toscanini was the symbol of great music in the United States in the 30s, 40s, early 50s. It's no accident that Sophie Tucker mentions him in the song that we heard at the top of the show. How he became a culture god in the United States was always something I wanted to understand myself. And I think that the reasons are fascinating and illuminating, and many of them have nothing to do with music.
What are some of the non-musical things that made him such a good candidate for a cult following?
He was a self-made man in the American mold to begin with. Unlike conductors like Mahler and Furtwängler, who were Toscanini rivals in the United States, which many people don't realize that Mahler and Toscanini were rival conductors in New York before World War I, and rival conductors in New York with the New York Philharmonic in the late 1920s. Unlike a Furtwängler or a Mahler, who both of whom were viewed in America as effete intellectuals, Toscanini was seen as a regular guy who chased skirts and was practical and efficient. In fact, early reviews of Toscanini called him, in the United States, the man who knows his business or a scientific conductor. He didn't have his head in the clouds. So that's one constellation of reasons, this whole self-made syndrome. There are a host of political reasons. Toscanini was, everybody knew that he was a conspicuous opponent of Mussolini and Hitler. The mere fact that he wasn't German was crucial, because our classical musical culture before World War I was a borrowed culture, and our symphonic culture was a German culture. Our conductors were Germans, our players were Germans, our repertoire was German. But once the Germans became enemies, German culture was stigmatized, and German conductors of stature who had proliferated in the northeastern United States before the First World War were unemployable in America. We needed a culture god, a European culture god still, because of the borrowed nature of the culture and our need for a validator of our own cultural achievement in our own eyes and in European eyes. We needed a culture god of that kind. We don't today. And he couldn't be German, but he had to be an accredited conductor of the German classics. All of those are some among many reasons that it was Toscanini who filled the bill, who was our culture god for great music.
You write about how Americans have been obsessed with the idea of genius, and Toscanini was officially considered a genius. What's this dwelling on genius about?
Dwelling on genius? I'm not sure what you have in mind.
Well, you write about the people were obsessed with genius, and they want. And Toscanini was a genius, and it was important to have geniuses, and that we kind of elevated geniuses to this god level.
Well, he certainly had a larger-than-life personality, which was an important component of his charisma. We were very impressed in America that he never used a score, for instance. In fact, he had a photographic memory, and one of the most cited facts about Toscanini from early on was that he'd memorized so many pages of music or so many symphonies or so many operas.
Do you think that hype helped him along the way, too, in establishing his reputation and his following in America?
Of course it did, but to dwell on the hype can be misleading. Toscanini was so important to us here for so many reasons, which were intrinsic to who we were, who he was, intrinsic to our need in those days for this kind of a cultural token or cultural icon, that the hype is just the icing on the cake. It's important and it's conspicuous, and certainly, especially by the time he got to the NBC Symphony, NBC and RCA having an elaborate public relations machine which they put at his disposal, especially in that period, the hype is very apparent. But you can't say that he was created by hype. For one thing, he was a very great conductor.
We should mention here that what you're talking about as Toscanini as the first real superstar isn't to detract from his abilities as a conductor at all.
The claims that were made for him in the United States were inherently hyperbolic. He was often called the first musician of the world or the greatest interpreter who ever lived. The second claim is obviously unverifiable. The first claim ignores, as the cult, the Toscanini cult did in general, people who create music, composers. To call Toscanini the world's first musician at a time when Schoenberg or Stravinsky or Bartok are active is obviously problematic at best.
You know, the people, the composers who you just mentioned are composers whose work he probably didn't conduct.
He barely conducted Stravinsky. He did not conduct Bartok. He did not conduct Schoenberg. And one of the problems with the Toscanini cult is that by the time he became a culture god in the United States, he was an old man, and he mainly conducted old music. He wasn't interested in new music. He wasn't interested in American music. And this had an unfortunate influence. What's especially regrettable and ironic is that concurrent with the Toscanini cult was a second phenomenon, which is just as important to my book, and that is what I call the new audience. After World War I, our audience for classical music and opera in the United States exploded. It grew exponentially. Radio was one reason, the phonograph, later television, a phenomenon sociologists call the new middle classes. All of this fed a vastly expanded audience for new music. this was simultaneous, I'm sorry, for classical music, and this was simultaneous with the coming of age of the American composer, with a period in the 20s and 30s where for the first time we seemed to be on the verge of creating a native tradition of serious music. Copland is probably the best known of these figures. So on the face of it, this was a propitious conjunction. You had the new audience, you had the come-of-age American composers, and yet they passed one another by. The new audience was actually antipathetic to American music. The composers were by and large antipathetic to the new audience.
Well, let's look at why you think that happened. Were there, this sounds really conniving, but do you think that there were almost like ulterior motives for liking classical music, you know, so that it had to be like the European masters as opposed to, you know, contemporary American composers?
I don't know that that sounds conniving at all. The new audience, in fact, was inculcated to conceive of great music as European music, and to conceive of great music as 18th and 19th century music. What I'm referring to especially is the music appreciation movement, which flourished in the 30s and the 40s. And if you look at the music appreciation materials, which I do in the book, you'll find that they elevate European, old European music. Not much just interested in new music or American music. There's a broader question, a broader issue of what happens inherently when you disseminate high culture or democratize high culture. And certainly the tendency is to gravitate towards more familiar, more traditional art forms and artworks.
Let's look at the music appreciation movement that you're describing. What were some of the... I mean, the whole idea of music appreciation, in a way, is that, that there's a mission behind classical music. It's not just listening to it and enjoying it, but there's some kind of deeper mission involved in disseminating it.
Absolutely. If you look at the music critics in the United States, before music appreciation times, before Toscanini times, and compare them to the critics of the Toscanini period, what you'll find is that the earlier generation of critics, the guys before World War I, are what I call armchair aesthetes. The best known is James Huneker. A couple others who were important were W.J. Henderson and Henry Krehbiel. They didn't care about proselytizing for music. They wrote books about music for the layman, but they were not mounting any soapboxes. They were not grabbing any short sleeves. All of that changed with music appreciation. That was a proselytizing movement. A lot of other things changed as well. The most dramatic change, I suppose, is that there was no longer the same emphasis on music making in the home. Music appreciation was a movement that told people, don't worry if you can't read music. Don't worry if you can't play an instrument. You can be just as smart as the next guy. And there's one quote in the book from George Merrick, who at one time was the music appreciation columnist for Good Housekeeping magazine. So he was writing for Housewives. Later he became an executive at RCA Victor. And what he says, in effect, in this little citation is, you can enjoy Beethoven's Fifth and know as much about it as the next guy. If you can't read music, if you don't know anything about Beethoven, if you don't know anything about the period in which he lived, I suppose it could sound very snobbish to rebuke Merrick and others like him for saying things like this. But personally, I don't think you have to be a snob to disagree with that type of advice. And in fact, the music appreciators themselves were snobs. They were snobs because they selected a canon of masterworks for general distribution. And then they would split hairs and say, well, this doesn't belong in the canon. The Beethoven Violin Concerto isn't as great as the Pastoral Symphony. The Pastoral Symphony isn't as great as the Ninth Symphony. And they certainly didn't think, on the whole, that modern music was as great as classical and romantic music.
Wasn't part of the point of the musical appreciation movement that music is edifying, you know, that you'll be a more...
It's uplifting.
You'll be a more cultured person if you listen to cultured music.
That's true, but at the same time, of course, it's not unique to that period.
Is that an American phenomenon, though? Do you think that, all that was grafted on classical music in Europe?
What's an American phenomenon is the popularizing movement of which music appreciation was a part. This isn't something I made up. It's something historians write about, that after World War I, due to demographic changes and changes in education and an increase in leisure time, there was a great popularizing movement. This is the period of the Book of the Month Club, Great Books courses, H.G. Wells' History of Mankind, Will Durant's Story of Philosophy. There was a great effort to introduce the world of high culture and great ideas to the man on the street. And music appreciation was part of that. And while this movement, I'm sure, has its analogs in Europe, there is also something rather inherently American about it. It has to do with democracy and democratization.
I've always assumed that in Europe that classical music is genuinely popular, and that it's not attached to all this edifying baggage that it is in America.
Well, it's true to one degree or another. Certainly, if you're looking at the phenomenon of Italian opera in the period of Verdi, you're talking about a popular art form. And we've never had a popular art form which at the same time seemed to embody all that was great about high culture as well, the way that Italians have had in the case of opera.
Well, let me ask you what your reservations are about the way Toscanini popularized classical music, or the way music appreciation tried to popularize classical music.
Well, the two most obvious, and we've already touched on them, are the fixation on the celebrity performer rather than on the music itself, and the identification of great art with something that's old and European.
So you hold Toscanini and the music appreciation movement in part responsible for the limited number of American composers who are shown off in most orchestral repertoires in America.
I wouldn't want to create the impression that I hold Toscanini personally responsible. In fact, I don't really talk in terms of specific villains in this book. It seems to me that the Toscanini cult, the music appreciation movement, were part of an impersonal, larger impersonal dynamic that was inevitable.
Okay, my guest is Joseph Horowitz. He's a music critic and author. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Joseph Horowitz. He's the author of the new book, Understanding Toscanini, and it looks at Toscanini as the first in a long line of celebrity conductors. Let's look at what's happening now in classical music, some of the things that you think Toscanini foreshadowed in classical music in America. Who tops what you call the glamour scale now? I really like that expression, by the way.
Oh, well, I guess it would be Von Karajan and Bernstein. At the very end of my book, I talk about what I call the long-term legacies of the Toscanini cult. And certainly the two attributes that we just talked about a moment ago, the fixation on celebrity performer and on an old world repertoire, are very much alive and well. We have the same problem today that we had in Toscanini times. At the same time, it would be a mistake. It would be misleading to describe Bernstein or Karajan or Pavarotti or anyone else today as being functionally equivalent with Toscanini. Toscanini was a great culture god in this country, partly because at the time we needed one, and that in turn was a reflection of a complex provincialism, which is no longer pertinent. We don't need a culture god. And in fact, there are no culture gods to the degree that they seem to embody great music the way Toscanini once did. Which isn't to say that I don't regard the Pavarotti cult or the Carrion cult is highly problematic, and the one certainly led to the other.
Well, you seem to be concerned that the superstar conductors are maybe overshadowing the music, that people go to hear, like, the great conductor, and you seem to wonder if that's at the expense of hearing the music itself.
Well, it seems to me we have an increasingly decadent and irrelevant musical culture. I'm talking about so-called classical music. Classical, the very term, in fact, is one which makes me uncomfortable.
Because it implies that the new is totally eliminated from the body of work.
Because it's taken on connotations that seem to me so parochial and divorced from intellectual inquiry. There was a time when you went to a concert, you'd hear new works as a matter of course, and you couldn't go home and listen to them on the radio. I'm talking about the 19th century. That began to change in the 20th century, and Toscanini was at the very center of the change. Today we have a musical culture which seems to me sunken in a malaise, and most of the concerts which attract the most attention, for instance on public television, seem to me wholly irrelevant to our cultural well-being, to the intellectual life of the United States.
Well, those public television concerts have really become very popular and have helped to popularize classical music. In what way do you think they're irrelevant?
The fixation on celebrity performers and on the warhorse repertoire, on top of which none of them, or very few of them, offer anything like the excitement of their predecessors or their precursors, which were the Toscanini telecasts, of which there were 10. And those, too, were focused on a celebrity performer and on the warhorse repertoire. But we can still see these on kinescopes. And they're a lot more exciting than, say, Zubin Mehta conducting the New York Philharmonic.
Do you think, in a way, public television has replaced the kind of music appreciation movement you were talking about earlier?
I wouldn't really say so. This scenario that I describe in my book, well, to briefly generalize, I talk about what happened when commercial radio and television gave way to public radio and television. And what amazes me is how much more enterprising radio was in the early days of its commercial existence than later, and how much more enterprising television was in the early days of its commercial existence than later. What I mean by that is early television, commercial television, included Leonard Bernstein, Young People's Concerts, Leonard Bernstein, Omnibus, CBS commissioning Stravinsky to do The Flood, NBC commissioning Menotti, the NBC Opera, which did opera in English, a lot of new works, a lot of American works. Can you imagine PBS commissioning an opera?
Because there's so much classical music on TV now, and because so many of the star conductors are on TV, do you think that TV is changing performance values? And what I'm wondering, for instance, on when you see someone conduct on television, you're seeing their face, and the conductor frequently looks like he's really in a state of reverie. Now, if you're in the audience for a concert, you're going to see their back, or maybe you'll see their profile, but you really won't see them full front. And I just wonder if a lot more theatrics have showmanship has entered into the art of conducting than previously existed.
I wouldn't say that, but I would say that the whole scene is more decadent, more mannerist, because it has to become so. After all, we're stuck with recycling the Beethoven symphonies over and over and over and over again. By the way, your question evokes for me a part of the Toscanini story, which was the incredible excitement of actually seeing Toscanini after these many decades of hearing him. What I mean by that is the excitement when Toscanini, who had been sequestered in a radio studio and only heard on the radio at the time when he was with the NBC Symphony, he was really not appearing very much in public, at public concerts. So the incredible excitement occasioned by those first telecasts where you could see Toscanini's face, and also by the transcontinental tour in 1950, which was arranged for him by David Sarnoff when he took the NBC Symphony on a coast-to-coast tour. This unprecedented opportunity to see Toscanini in the flesh really drove people crazy.
Joe Horowitz is my guest. He's a music critic and author, author of the new book, Understanding Toscanini. Now, I don't know when this started, but I know you write at the end of your book that you've basically given up going to the Metropolitan Opera to New York and to Avery Fisher Hall, which is, you know, one of the more important concert halls in Manhattan. Have you really soured that much on classical music performance?
I don't know if soured is the right term. The fact is these institutions, more and more, are simply museums. And for various reasons, they don't even serve their museum functions well. The institutions which occupy them, the Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera, I call dinosaurs. And what seems to me to keep these dinosaurs alive past their normal allotted lifespan is an artificial respiration mechanism, which boils down to marketing. In fact, you can even take college courses now in marketing the arts. And through radiothons and sophisticated computerized mailings and what have you, people are able to keep these houses full of warm bodies that pay money for tickets. Otherwise, it would be hard to account for their longevity.
You were a classical music critic with the Times, New York Times, from 76 to 80. Did you give that up for similar reasons?
Yeah. One of the reasons I stopped being a music critic, and I do no longer consider myself one, is I simply would no longer, my views no longer fell within the acceptable parameters. I found that the events that I was covering, I found that my reservations were so extreme within, in terms of the consensus that prevailed, say, at the New York Times, that I really couldn't go on reviewing them.
What would you like to see happen in classical music in America? What kind of repertoire would you like? How would you like to see the repertoire expanded?
Well, this is a difficult question and one which I barely deal with in my book. I don't pose as the answer man. But if you were talking about the context of New York City, I'd say certainly there were venues more propitious than Lincoln Center. They tend to be in downtown and in Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Academy of Music, which has problems of its own, is certainly a hub of new music activity right now, to the degree that Fisher Hall and Metropolitan Opera certainly are not.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been nice to have you here.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
My guest has been writer Joseph Horowitz, and his new book, Understanding Toscanini, looks at Toscanini as the first in a long line of celebrity conductors in America. Understanding Toscanini has just been published by Knopf. My guest name again, Joseph Horowitz. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is made possible with a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from National Public Radio member stations and the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Julian Barnes talks about his latest novel, Staring at the Sun. In it, we discover that the question, does God exist, has more answers than you might think. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz gives his thoughts on a recent reissue of performances by pianist Arthur Schnabel. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg talks about Hollywood accents. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, this news. This is Fresh Air. Arthur Schnabel was one of the foremost pianists in the first half of this century. He first performed in his native Austria and later played throughout Europe and the United States. Schnabel was a purist in both his devotion to the classics and in his performance style. Many of his old recordings are now available on compact disc. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been listening to one of them and has this review.
I love Arthur Schnabel. I wish I'd been around to hear him play the piano in person, one of the few reasons I'd want to be older. Of course, the reason I know him at all is that he recorded. He recorded a lot. In the 30s, he became the first pianist to record all the Beethoven sonatas. And fortunately, most of his recordings have been available at one time or another since his death in 1951. Some of his greatest recordings have been issued by Arabesque on compact disc. These include most of his astonishing Schubert records. He was probably the most important rediscoverer of Schubert's piano music in this century. And his first complete set of the five Beethoven concertos, conducted by Sir Malcolm Sargent in the early 30s. Schnabel is often classified among the intellectual musicians. But as is often the case, intellectual probably has more to do with intuitive emotional understanding than with any abstract theories. A Schnabel performance is characterized by the most poignant phrasing you've ever heard, with an uncanny lightness of touch and glistening tone that is never self-congratulatory, but always at the service of some greater and deeper expression of the music. Listen to his timing in this transitional section from the slow movement of the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto. I think you can often tell more about performers from the way they handle transitions than from the way they play either the big tunes or the ferocious virtuoso stuff. It's a sign of how deeply they understand an entire piece. At the beginning of the movement, there's a sort of war going on between the orchestra and the soloist. Liszt compared this amazing passage to the story of Orpheus taming the wild beasts with his lyre. Gradually, with the quietest of voices, the piano begins to calm the rage of the orchestra, and finally succeeds. But for me, the greatest moment of all, and no one else I've ever heard plays this like Schnabel, comes in the sudden series of ominously rising trills and obsessive downward runs in the piano. This is the one sign that this effort, this attempt music makes to civilize our uncontrollable instincts, has its cost. If nothing else, a momentary but terrifying glimpse into the abyss. Then peace is movingly restored, and the piano can sail away with the orchestra into the practically undiluted joy of the last movement.
Thank you.
That was Arthur Schnabel playing the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto. It's wonderful to have these Schnabel recordings conveniently available in the latest technology, though in the Beethoven concertos, I actually prefer the scratchier but more spacious sound of the arabesque LP versions. And if truth be told, nothing comes near the warmth and clarity of the original 78s played on the best modern equipment. But of course, the important thing is that they're available at all, and that someone in power feels that even after half a century, it's still important to hear these performances, which have never been equaled.
Lloyd Schwartz is a poet and classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
British writer Julian Barnes captured American readers 2 years ago with the publication of his novel Flaubert's Parrot. Critics praised Barnes for his imaginative blending of fiction, biography, and literature. Barnes was working as a TV critic when Flaubert's Parrot was published here. His two previous novels, Metroland and Before She Met, are now available in this country. But fans will have to wait for his crime stories, written under the pen name Dan Kavanaugh, to appear in American bookstores. Barnes' new book is called Staring at the Sun. This novel follows the life of a young woman, beginning in 1921 and ending 100 years later.
This excerpt comes from the early part of the book, where the heroine, Jean Sargent, is a naive young woman about to get married. And one of the wiser women of the village has given her a book on sexology to break the news to her gently. The first night, she leafed through the book carelessly, skipping whole chapters called Sleep, Children, Society, and Appendix. If she did this, it didn't really count as reading. Even so, phrases dropped from the page and stuck like burrs to her flannelette nightdress. Some of them made her laugh. Some of them made her apprehensive. The word turgid kept appearing, and so did crisis. She didn't like the sound of those two. Enlarged and stiffened, she read. Lubricated by mucus, turgid again, soft, small, and drooping, ugh, maladjustment of the relative shapes and positions of the organs, partial absorption of the man's secretions, congestion of the womb. She was astonished by how often the word sex seemed to be married to some other word, sex attraction, sex ignorance, sex tide, sex life, sex function. Lots of hyphens everywhere. Sex hyphens, she thought. She tried hard, but couldn't understand a lot of what was being said. The author made great claims to write plainly and straightforwardly, but Jean got lost almost at once. Soul structures, she read, and the rift within the lute, which she didn't much want to think about. The clitoris corresponds morphologically to the man's penis. What could that mean?
Julian Barnes, I think that's a very funny example of an issue which you seem to be pretty obsessed with, which is that language doesn't always do what it's supposed to do. It doesn't always describe well what it means to.
That's right. It's interesting that a lot of readers of this book have assumed that I made up this false and misleading language. In fact, the interesting and ironic thing is that it's all direct quotations from the most famous book in our country, which was of the sort that was given to young wives. It was called Married Love, and it was by Mary Stopes, who was very famous in our country. I don't know if she's known in yours. And it's ironic because at the time, this was considered the most plain-speaking book available. And it was, women read this, you see, and they read all this stuff, and they thought, that's what it's really like. And then two generations, or perhaps half a generation on, you read it, and it seems opaque and mysterious. And you can't understand how they got anything right after reading this book.
In your novels, you seem to really take great joy, both in wonderful writing and in very funny or very inspired flourishes, but also you seem to really get a kick out of bad writing. I mean, you quote...
Other people's bad writing.
Other people's bad writing.
Let's get this straight.
No, no. Yeah. That's right. If it was your own bad writing, then a little enjoyment to be had. No, but in Flaubert's Parrot and in your new book, Staring at the Sun, there are several passages where you're quoting somebody else's bad writing, and it's really very funny, and I know that as the writer, you're really enjoying it yourself.
Yes, that's true. I mean... I was very attracted actually by this bad writing in this book of sexology, because, I mean, there's a lot of bad writing which doesn't really mislead or misleads about unimportant things or low levels of experience. But there's something, it seems to me, not just funny but deeply poignant about the idea of someone not knowing anything about sex and trying to learn it from books which use words like, you know, lubricated by mucus, you know, that sounds like something pretty nasty.
I have a feeling you have a real love-hate relationship with words.
Oh, I don't know where you get the idea of the hate part of it. I mean, I have a love relationship with words. One of my earliest jobs was as a lexicographer on the Oxford English Dictionary.
Really?
Yes, I worked there for 3 years. So I suppose I'm particularly skilled in words beginning with letters A to G, which came into our language between 1880 and 1975, but I don't think it shows in my prose.
Well, I'll tell you why I thought you might hate language as
yes.
well as love it.
Yes.
First of all, your main character at one point talks, I forget exactly what the quote is, but she says sometimes she gets fed up with words.
Yes.
And one of your great literary idols, I don't know if that's too strong a word, is Flaubert, who was obsessed with words and with le mot juste, with the right word, and I think that could be
that's
torture
true.
As well as
yes, I
fulfilling.
See what you mean. I mean, if you're obsessed with using words as precisely and perfectly as you can, then at some point you're bound to sort of butt up against the sort of the extremities of the use of words. You know that at some point words don't cover the whole of experience.
You seem to be interested in riddles and hypotheses and unanswerable questions. There's a lot of those in your new book.
In the new book there is, and indeed it was originally called Question and Answer. One diligent critic in England counted up the number of question marks there were in the book, and I think he
how
came
many
to
were
sort of,
there?
Well, I think he came to 500 or 600, but I haven't done the count myself.
It's
so
an interesting form
you know.
Of literary criticism.
That's right. Yes, I think he probably just tried it for about 20 pages, and then he multiplied by 10 or something like that. But it makes a fair point.
You devote more than a couple of pages to answers to the question: is there a God?
Yes, that's right. Towards the end of the book, the son of the questioning Gene Sargent gets obsessed by. We've now moved forward to the next century, and he gets obsessed by the question of whether God exists or not. And so he sets out a sort of series of hypotheses.
Would you read a few?
Yes, sure. Well, we start with the two obvious ones. One, that God exists. Two, that God does not exist. Three, that God used to exist, but doesn't anymore. Four, that God does exist, but that he's abandoned us. A, because we've been a severe disappointment to him, or B, because he gets bored easily. Five, that God did exist, doesn't exist at the moment, but will exist again in the future. He's merely taking a divine sabbatical at the moment. This would explain a lot. Six, that God hasn't existed so far at all, but will exist in the future. He will arrive at some point to clear away our garbage, trim the grass in the public parks, and gentrify the neighborhood. God is an overworked maintenance man in a stained boiler suit, with far too many planets to look after. We should consider paying more and having a regular maintenance contract instead of calling him out on an emergency basis as we do now. And one more, if we've got time for it, that there are several gods. This might explain a lot. A, they might always be quarrelling, and so no one is minding the shop. B, they might be paralysed by an excess of democracy, like the United Nations. Each god has a veto, and so nothing gets past the Security Council. Small wonder that our planet is derelict. C, this subdivision of responsibility has weakened their strength and weakened their concentration. They might be able to see what is going wrong, and yet do nothing about it. Perhaps the gods are benign but powerless. Perhaps they can merely look on, like eunuchs in a harem.
How did you come up with those answers to the question, does God exist?
Well, I just sat down and thought of them, actually. I certainly didn't go reading through religious philosophy and so on to find examples. I think I got one of them from a pamphlet on heresy or something like that I did look up. I ran them through a friend of mine who's a philosopher to see if he could come up with any more possibilities, but he couldn't add any to them. It's a game, but it's a serious game when you do something like that. And it's the sort of bursts of writing that I like doing very much.
Okay. Julian Barnes, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Julian Barnes' new novel is titled Staring at the Sun. This is Fresh Air. Stay tuned for full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with the show's co-host, Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Tonight on the program, we'll have some reports about the death of Benjamin Lyndon, the American who was killed in Nicaragua, evidently by anti-government or Contra rebels. Also, a report about the guilty plea entered today by Carl Channel, known as Spitz Channel, the conservative fundraiser. It's the first guilty plea entered in the Contra-Iran arms scandal investigation. And the counts which he pleaded guilty to evidently also involve Oliver North as an unindicted co-conspirator.
I understand you're also starting a big series tonight.
Yes, on surveillance. Tonight's first report is on surveillance in everyday life.
Okay, Robert Siegel, thank you very much. All Things Considered is coming up later today from National Public Radio. Meryl Streep is one of Hollywood's most sought-after actresses. One of the reasons is that she uses accents so convincingly. Polish for Sophie's Choice, British for The French Lieutenant's Woman. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some observations on the evolution of accents in the movies.
Hollywood didn't used to care much about the authenticity of movie accents. Claude Rains talked the same way whether he was playing an English rake, a French policeman, or a senator from Montana. And nobody seemed to mind that Clark Gable played Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty, with vowels that could only have been shaped in Ohio, and with never a word of explanation. Yet, curiously, casting directors did used to pay attention to accents in certain films, and precisely those in which accents should have been entirely irrelevant. Take the ancient Roman costume epics that flourished until the 1950s, Quo Vadis, Spartacus, The Robe, and so forth. There were strict linguistic conventions in these films, which, needless to say, had nothing to do with the Latin or Hebrew of the period. The Roman patricians had to be played by British actors like Peter Ustinov or Laurence Olivier. The heroes, Christians, slaves, gladiators, depending on the film, the heroes were played by Americans like Kirk Douglas or Charlton Heston. And in the roles of apostles, you had to have Jews or Irishmen, almost always either Sam Jaffe or Finlay Curry. This casting was crucial to the key scene in all these movies, when a Roman patrician, say, was interrogating a young Christian girl. The captain has these impeccable West End vowels, and he says something like, "This Nazarene you speak of, how many legions has he?" And the Christian girl answers, 12, my lord." 12 legions? Why have I not heard of them?" 12 men, my lord." 12 men? Why, what are 12 men against all that is Rome?" Of course, sometimes box office realities intruded in the casting process. But in these films, unlike Mutiny on the Bounty, say, you had to put something in the script that would explain away the oddity. In Spartacus, for example, Jean Simmons was cast as a Christian. Her British accent was explained by making her a British slave. Never mind that the British in those days were wild tribesmen who liked to paint themselves blue and dance around the local henge. You weren't supposed to inquire too deeply into these things. In fact, these movies used accents to explain the difference between Christians and Romans, which, as it happens, was just like the difference between Americans and Europeans. As the American poet Randall Jarrell put it, they are smarter than we, and we are better than they. Their sophistication has, unfortunately, made them bad, just as our naivete has, fortunately, kept us good. Nowadays, of course, movie accents in general are supposed to be naturalistic. When they remade Mutiny on the Bounty in 1962, Marlon Brando was required to play Fletcher Christian with a British accent, which he apparently produced by knitting his eyebrows together until his adenoids screamed in pain. And by way of revenge, we've had to listen to actors like Lawrence Harvey and Albert Finney giving us their versions of American speech. But curiously, the linguistic conventions of fantasy have survived. True, the evil empires of recent movies are operating out of Death Stars rather than the Seven Hills of Rome. Yet even in far-off galaxies, evidently, the Force tends to favor those who pronounce their R's.
Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is a consultant at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. That's our show for today. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with film director Jill Godmillow. Her new film, Waiting for the Moon, is based on the relationship between poet Gertrude Stein and her longtime companion, Ellis B. Toklas. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review Prince's new album, Sign of the Times, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review Prick Up Your Ears, a new film about gay British playwright Joe Orton. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant is Ed Doherty. The engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. Fresh Air is produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.